Last week, while we were doing our class, I mentioned that if people were interested, they could let me know how they want the last two classes to go, as to where we're going to go. I had several different possible endings to this class in mind. Hadn't made up my mind last week. What people told me, those who told me, and if you didn't tell me, that's your own fault. But those who came and told me what they wanted for the last 2 weeks all had the same thing in mind. They said something to the effect of, well, you can't just leave the story there. As far as I was concerned, we hit the climax, the birth of Christ. We had our, as literary people say, our denouement. We had the death of Herod the Great. Got rid of the villain. I was okay with leaving it there, but, you know, apparently some others wanted to know, well, what came next? You've introduced lots of people, and not all of them have completed their story. So we're going to complete the story as much as we can this week and next week. It does occasionally drift us over into the New Testament period. But I thought about it, and I said, well, intertestamental really doesn't really pick up till the ministry of Christ and John the Baptist, if you're talking about the years of silence. And there is still another 30-something years that we've got to cover before Christ's ministry began. So that's what we're going to look at. If you've still got your list of Herods, may even be more important this week than before. I'm going to point out some errors. It's what happens when you borrow somebody else's chart. I thought I had whited out all the errors, but I found four more errors just looking at it this evening. What happens, people get confused, and therefore it's understandable. I'll try to point them out as we get to them, so you can cross them out or make some corrections on your chart there if you've got that. I hate when I miss the fact that I had some dates wrong, and I thought I had gotten them all whited out, but I missed a few at least. Well, we got to Herod's death. We got to his sister freeing the captives, the 700 captives that were supposed to be slaughtered by Salome, his sister. And instead she freed them and the people celebrated. I said it didn't quite work out the way she wanted it. She probably thought she would become queen. As the people rejoiced, she was so kind to release them. But Herod had a will. And we'll pick up the story with Herod and his will, as well as with his sister. We're going to sort of do it the Paul Harvey way. We're going to tell the rest of the story. We've hit the main part of the story, and now we're going to sort of fill in the things that we're missing. So with Salome the First, Herod's sister, her second husband, she actually had three. So the one who was with her at the freeing of the people was her third husband. The first one got killed, remember, by Herod, Joseph. Her second husband, Costobarus, she divorced him. And then she had a third husband right at the end of Herod's life. Her second husband was the governor of Idumea. Remember, that's where Herod came from. He appointed Costobarus as the governor. And they had some children who are at least worth thinking about, knowing who they were to some extent. One of their sons was Antipater. Yet another person with the same name. That'd be the third one that we've talked about. Antipater isn't significant himself. It's who his mother wanted to be king, but he never became king. But he had two sons named Saul and Costobar, and they actually are significant in the Jewish revolt that comes later. Not that they were great heroes of the people and tried to revolt against Rome. Quite the contrary, their idea was to help Rome by killing as many zealots as they could, which just made the revolt get worse and worse because they kept killing zealots and the zealots kept growing in numbers. Eventually, during the early days of the Jewish revolt, they actually got besieged in a castle along with a cousin by the zealots. The brothers managed to escape. Their cousin said it wasn't right to escape. He felt it was his duty to stay and to continue the fight on behalf of Rome. And so the cousin was captured by the zealots and beheaded. The brothers made it to the Roman lines, told them who they were, and the Romans sent them to Greece, where they stayed the rest of their lives. The other child of Salome, probably of more importance, at least for the New Testament, was Bernice. There's another Bernice. We'll get to her maybe next week. This Bernice is one who married Aristobulus. If you're looking at your play-by-play, especially if you got the other side of it, the Maccabean family, you can sort of realize that Aristobulus, he's in the center. He died in 7 BC. But he's a Maccabean. He's of the Hasmonean. So her children become kind of important. They have a right to the kingship, or at least they felt they did. And we'll get back to Bernice. We're going to keep coming back to Bernice and Aristobulus and their kids. Getting back to Salome, she didn't get to be queen like she had hoped, but rather Augustus names her Toparch. And you might think, well, that's a weird name. It means ruler of a district, ruler of a topographic area. And this was really because that's what Herod put in his will. We'll get to the will in a moment. But he put in his will that he wanted his sister to have a district. And you can see how much, you know, Herod, right? We all know Herod well after last week's lesson. You can see how much Herod loved his sister. He gave her two little itty-bitty towns on the edge of the Jordan River. And he gave her what was considered a rather small amount of money. It was actually 4,500 denarii a year, which isn't really a small amount of money, but for somebody who's been used to living in the king's palace, it wasn't very much. And he gave her one port city, Ashdod. When Augustus read the will, he said, that's silly. I'll give you Ashkelon, and I'll give you the whole area around it, basically the whole land of the Philistines. So he expanded, actually, he more than doubled Herod's gift to his sister. And he gave her all the revenues from all those lands. So she actually turned out a little bit well. She continued as Toparch for 14 years. It'd be 12 years, right? We did the math thing last week. I always want to do it as an algebra equation. She continued as for 12 years, 80, 10. When she died, the area of Ashkelon and Ashdod and the whole area of the Philistines wasn't turned over to Judea as everyone expected. Augustus said it'd be better to attach that to the legate of Syria rather than giving it to Judea. And as far as those two cities, the emperor's wife decided from visiting that she really liked the area, so the emperor decided to declare that an imperial estate. And they built themselves a palace there, and the emperors actually all kept it for the next 100 years as their imperial, sort of their summer thing or winter thing. If they wanted to go to that area, they had a place to live. So on a map, just to show you where these things were, she got the two gray areas I got the arrows pointing at, the one that we're familiar with, the land of the Philistines, and the two cities and a little bit of the surrounding district along the Jordan River, a little bit north of the Dead Sea. And as I said, that's the area that became an imperial estate separate from the land of Judea. Well, if you're looking at your list of Herod's kids, and you realize the oldest three are all dead because Herod killed them over the last couple years of his life, the next son in line would have been Herod Philip I, also called Herod II. If you go online, you can see the big debate among scholars as to whether he was Herod Philip I or he was Herod II. I don't think that they named him that way. It's all what later scholars decided to call them. But he was the oldest surviving son. He was 22. Somebody asked after class last week how old the three boys were who died. The oldest one, who died just a few days before his father, was 34. The next two boys, who died a couple years earlier, were in their late 20s. I think one was 29 and the other like 26 when he was. They were executed. So the oldest surviving son, Herod Philip I, he was the son of Mariamne II. Remember, she was the daughter of Boethus. Boethus was the Egyptian Jew who basically married off his daughter so he could become high priest. That was sort of the exchange. It happened at the same time. Here's my daughter. Thank you. I get the high priesthood. So you would think, perfect candidate, right? To be king or high priest or both, right? He was also married to Herodias, the daughter of Berenice and Aristobulus. Remember, Aristobulus is in the Maccabean succession. So Herodias is in that succession. And you would think, oh yeah, still. That's kind of what his father did, right? You marry into the royal family. It gives you a good solid basis to be royalty. They had one daughter, Salome. Salome II, who, anyone remember what Salome did? This is the one you're familiar with. Okay, yeah, the one who danced before Herod Antipas, when asked, what do you want up to half my kingdom? She went and asked her mother, and her mother said, I want the head of John the Baptist. And that's the story there in Mark chapter 6. She's not named there. We know who she is. Josephus names her, as well as other historians, so we know who she was. It was their only daughter of Herodias and Philip I. And she later marries Herod Philip II, which is her father's half-brother. You can get the ewes out. Yeah, she married her father's half-brother. But as far as Philip I, he remained in Rome. When Herod was dying, all of Herod's sons, I should have pointed out at some point, all of Herod's sons eventually went to Rome. Usually when they're between 5 and 10, he sent them away. The older ones he didn't bring back till they were in their 20s. But when Herod was getting ready to die those last few years, he not only brought back his favorite son, who he killed, he brought back the rest of the sons. He sent messages for all of them to return. Herod Philip I, perhaps showing great wisdom for one so young, decided it was safer to stay in Rome than to go home to dad. And how do you think Herod the Great took the defiance of his oldest son? Not well, yeah. But he was safe. He was in Rome. So he did the only thing he could do. Anyone got a guess? Yeah, he disinherited him. He said, that's not my son anymore. Wrote him right out of the will. That's not my son. Don't give him anything. And so Herod Philip at least lives peacefully, continues in Rome after the death of his father as a private citizen, completely out of the politics. But his brother Herod Antipas came to visit sometime around AD 26. Herod Philip, being a good half-brother, put Antipas up in his own home. Antipas had an affair with Herodias, the wife of Philip, and they ran off together. Herodias then divorced Herod Philip I. That is, she's the one who initiated it. Yes, under Roman law, that was a possibility. How did the Jews feel about that? Jews did not accept that. They took Deuteronomy 24 to mean only the man can divorce the woman, that a woman didn't have a right to divorce. Roman civil law, women or men had the right to divorce. So Herodias divorced Philip, ran off with Herod Antipas and got married. And of course, that brings about the whole story of John the Baptist, who confronted them. We'll talk a little bit more about them when we get to Herod Antipas next week. As far as Philip the First, and that's one of the mistakes, actually it's two of the mistakes on this chart. He died in 33 AD, possibly even 32 AD, and he never ruled in Iturea. That's whoever wrote the chart got confused between Philip the First and Philip the Second. Philip the Second rules, not Philip the First. Philip I never ruled, but he did take a travel to Arabia in his 50s. He was walking in the desert, and he never came back. They found his body. They assumed he died of heat stroke while taking a walk in the desert, while visiting the king of Arabia. Now we go to Archelaus. We even have a picture of Herod Archelaus. And what does the New Testament tell us about Herod Archelaus? Not very much, but he is mentioned. And, oh, that's one of the other mistakes. It has Archelaus, it says Matthew 2:2. It's Matthew 2:22. So if you don't know the answer to my question, you can look at Matthew 2:22. It's the only verse that mentions Archelaus. And what does our New Testament tell us? Somebody who finds it. Okay, when they knew that Herod was dead and Archelaus, they knew it was safe to come back. But when Joseph hears it's Archelaus who's ruling, he does what? They go around. They go beyond Judea. They go on, go back to Nazareth. And we'll talk about why here in just a moment. Herod Archelaus was the daughter of Malthas the Samaritan. And how did Jews feel about Samaritans? They didn't like him. Man, now his dad was a Idumean. His mom was a Samaritan. That's probably even worse than the Idumean with the... And his father was Idumean and Arabian. So you got Idumean, you got Arabian, and you got Samaritan. Three groups that the Jews didn't like any of them. So he sort of combines all the things that the Jews disliked even before you get to his life. Well, dad's dead. It's March. Remember, we discussed that last week. It's March 14th. Dad's dead. There's a big feast about to come. Anyone know the big feast that's going to come in this early spring of every year for the Jews? Passover. Yeah, Passover is going to be the big feast. So when Passover rolls around, that year it was April 10, 28 days after his father died. Archelaus decides that he's the oldest son, forgetting about the one who was disinherited, and he shows up for the festival dressed all in white. A kingly garment. And he had a royal golden throne set before the people, and he mounted the steps and sat down before the people on a golden throne, obviously declaring that he's going to be the king, right? Kind of doing it symbolically. He was all of 18 years old. And if you can think about being 18 and now... looks like you're going to be the next king, at least you hope you are, you think you are. And he announced to the people at this gathering, the Passover, big gathering for the Jews, he announced he's going to be the kinder, gentler king, the king they always wished that Herod could have been. Remember the mercy of Herod? We talked about that last week. He said he'd be merciful. He just killed them rather than burn those. He said he's going to be much kinder and gentler than his father was. And as long as they were nice and, you know, they accepted his kingship, he would do some things for them, you know, the things they want. He would lower their taxes. He would free their political prisoners, you know, those that his father had put in jail. He would do all these great things in the future as long as they don't protest him becoming king, right? He doesn't want any problems with Rome. You can see politicians are all the same. They're always promising lower taxes, right? The Pharisees and the Sadducees started working the crowds at that Passover. Remember, hundreds of thousands of Jews in the town for Passover. The Pharisees and Sadducees started working the crowd to make demands. Right? Remind you of what happens with Jesus later. They were used to doing this. And one of their demands was they wanted a new high priest. Remember, Herod was always appointing relatives. And the current one was yet another relative. They said, get rid of, actually it would be your father's son-in-law, or brother-in-law. Get rid of him. The Pharisees wanted a more pious high priest. The Sadducees wanted a Sadducee, and those weren't the same things, and they didn't think they were. Sadducees weren't pious. We talked about that. They were political. But they claimed they were the sons of Zadok, and they should be high priest. Pharisees thought, well, if we don't know who should be high priest, we should at least put somebody religious in as high priest, meaning, of course, a Pharisee. But they were both agreed that they needed to get rid of the guy who was currently on the high priest. And they also wanted, especially the Pharisees, wanted justice. Remember that year before, those two rabbis, Pharisees, and the 40 young men who were burned alive. Can't get Herod for it. We want all the officers who ordered the men to light the fires. We want them put to death. All right? They probably said they were just following orders, but the Pharisees wanted them to be punished for what they had done. And the crowds were getting loud, and Archelaus said, okay, I'll do that for you also when I get back from Rome. I first got to go to Rome. I've got to get my kingdom. And when I come back, I'll lower the taxes, I'll free the prisoners, and I'll punish the officers who were guilty of lighting the fires. And it sounds like, you know, they've won, right? If you know the Herods, how much do you trust the word of Herod Archelaus? Probably not a lot. So now that he was done with his grandstanding, Herod Archelaus did what you'd expect any 18-year-old kid raised to power and fame and to money and raised in pagan Rome. He said, go on with your feast and I'm going back to the palace for mine. And he invited his young friends to come back to the feast for a Roman-style feast. You go on with Passover, we're going to have a Roman orgy, you know, party, you know. drinking, women, you know, the whole bit. He's 18, he's got all kinds of power. So he goes back to the palace. They're starting to have a good time back in the palace. Passover sacrifices were still being offered. And the Pharisees and Sadducees decide that it's still a good time to work the crowd. And so they start hinting that, you know, Archelaus isn't going to be good on his word. You know, and we're never going to get justice. And they get the people to start mourning, making wailing sounds like somebody had died. The screaming of women as somebody had died, the wailing crowds. And it got to be so loud, it was actually disturbing the party that was going on in the palace. And as you'd expect of any 18-year-old whose party's being disturbed, he tells some servants to go out there and tell those people to be quiet. And when those servants get out there to tell those people to be quiet, the people start picking up stones and throwing them at the servants, telling them to go away. And the servants come back and say, hey, they don't want to be quiet. In fact, they're getting louder now that we've tried to tell them to be quiet. And like anyone over-pampered and with lots of power, he sends an officer with some soldiers. You go and make them be quiet. Or else. And if you were in the crowd and you got hundreds of thousands of people all wailing, and now you got a handful of soldiers and one officer who comes out and tells you be quiet, the crowd decides to attack. And they pick up larger stones. And some of the soldiers are actually stoned to death in the Jewish fashion, killed right there on the ground. A few of them escape back to the palace, and they tell Herod, well, they're not going to be quiet. In fact, they're still getting louder, and the sacrifices are still going on, and a few of your men are dead. And as an 18-year-old, he said, call out the army. And he ordered the army of his father to attack the people in the temple. Three 3,000 Jews were how many bodies were counted the next morning. Could have been more who died, but that's how many bodies they said were counted in the morning. And once they got done with the slaughter, the army was posted around the temple and announced that Passover was ended. There would be no more sacrifices. There would be no Passover. Crowds were to go home. You weren't welcome in Jerusalem any longer because Herod's got a party going on, and the party continued. Herod's party. And Archelaus then set sail. After his party, he set sail to go to Rome to claim his kingdom. And when he got there, Augustus, the emperor, was presented with three different wills of Herod the Great. He was presented with the original will that named Antipater as his chief heir and the brothers Alexander and Aristobulus as joint second heirs. Problem with that will is, what's happened to all three of those people? Yeah, Herod killed them all. So that will was, you know, discarded because there's nobody to claim the throne there. The second will, named Herod Antipas as his sole heir, with some small things for Salome and for some of the other heirs, but basically Herod Antipas would be king. Problem with that will was that Herod changed his mind, apparently just hours before he died. And that was the third will, disinheriting Herod Antipas just moments, you know, hours before he died, and making Herod Archelaus the sole heir, with some small territories for Salome. And actually, even though Herod Antipas was disinherited, he still, Herod made provision for him, so he wasn't completely disinherited like Herod Philip. And Herod Philip II was also going to be given some small territories, kind of like Salome. But Herod put at the very end of it that he trusted Augustus to do the right thing and make a final decision because something might have happened. I think he was probably worried that, you know, one of these sons might have been the one who kills him. And if Augustus knew that, then he could make some changes to this. But Augustus took it to mean he could do whatever he wanted. And that's why he gave Salome a bigger portion than what Herod had willed to her. Herod Antipas also showed up in Rome, just like Herod Archelaus, both asking to be made king. Right? They both wanted to be the sole heir. They both had their own will. They both had their own lawyers. And the Pharisees and Sadducees sent a deputation of about 50 men to appear before Augustus to demand that the emperor take over the territory and get rid of these guys. You know, we don't want them. We especially don't want Archelaus. After all, he killed 3,000 of us just a few days ago or weeks ago at this point. We don't want him. Get rid of him. And, you know, we'd rather not have any of them. We'd rather just be an imperial province and you appoint somebody. You can imagine how that went over with the brothers, right? Archelaus thought ahead, though. He brought two officials of his father, Herod the Great. One of them was actually a well-known man, even at that time. And he brought them because they attested that the will was genuine. Herod Antipas said it was a fake, you know. Or they did it after Herod, you know, the Great had lost his mind those last few days. He was obviously crazy. We talked about that last week, right? I mean, he was killing people right and left. He was killing his own sons. He was obviously out of his mind. So Archelaus brought these two men and said, no, no, we were there. We watched him sign this. This is really his. And one of them was the ring bearer, the signet bearer, who stamped it with Herod's seal. He said, yeah, I stamped it because Herod signed it. The chief speaker of the two was Nicolaus of Damascus. You may not be familiar with him, but he was actually a noted scholar, a philosopher, and a historian. Wrote lots and lots and lots of books. He had also been a tutor to the children of Mark Antony and Cleopatra. And he argued, good lawyer, he argued that 3,000, the demonstration that he was willing to kill 3,000 Jews showed how loyal he was to Rome. He's going to be the best king because, you know, he'll even kill his own people to keep them peaceful. Only a lawyer could believe that story, right? But that's his argument, and it actually worked. The other witness, by the way, was his brother, so it's not like he had some unbiased people. But Augustus agreed to it. Thought, yes, he must be a good king, but he didn't make him king. He made him ethnarch, which means ruler of an ethnicity or ruler of a people, which gave him the title king, king of the Jews, not king of Judea. His father was king of Judea as well as king of the Jews. Archelaus was king of the Jews, not king of Judea. He was ruler only over the people. And he was also made tetrarch, which means ruler of one-fourth or one-fourth of the kingdom. He was going to get only one out of four pieces of Herod's kingdom as his own territory, but he was actually going to be responsible for the people of all four territories, all the Jews. Kind of a weird idea, right? Of, you know, he's responsible for the people, but not for the territory. He doesn't get all the revenue. And so he was responsible for Judea, Idumea, and Samaria. And not surprisingly, Nicolaus and his brother receive a large cash gift from somebody after their testimony, and they settle down and live happily ever after in Rome, writing books. They had a patron, they said, a secret patron. I don't think it's secret, right? Archelaus obviously paid them a large sum of money to say that this was Herod's will, and that Herod really wanted Archelaus to be king. And so Archelaus gets the territories in green. Actually, it goes a little bit further south than what it shows up there because it included Idumea. But basically, the areas there, Samaria and Judea, became under his control. So Archelaus has a title, King of the Jews. He has some territory. He's a tetrarch. He returns to Jerusalem. Well, things hadn't been peaceful while he was gone. Remember those 50 guys who came and said, don't do this to us. They sailed back first to tell the people, no, it didn't work out. But they actually found that the land was in rebellion. Because while he was gone, Rome had appointed a procurator, a temporary one. His name was Sabinus, to keep the peace while Augustus was trying to decide who should be king and to keep the tribute coming because, of course, Rome needs its taxes. On Pentecost, which comes how many days after Passover? 50 days. So not very long after both Archelaus and Antipas had sailed to go to Rome, the people began protesting. Remember the Pharisees and Sadducees stirring the people up again. Their Passover had been disrupted. People had been slaughtered. Now the people have come back together. And Sabinus did basically what Archelaus had did. He sent in the troops, told the people to go home. And then he did something else. He said, hey, as long as we got all the people out of the temple, you troops, go raid the treasury. Bring it here. He said it was to pay for the cost of the men, but we all know what he really wanted. He wanted the money. It was a common thing among Romans, you know, if you could get away with stealing some treasure, steal the treasure. The crowds were still in town, and they heard the treasure was being stolen by the guards, and the crowds came back and started killing the guards, or the crowd came back, started killing the guards. The guards started fighting, more people came to town, and basically civil war broke out in Jerusalem. Sabinus appealed to the Syrian legate. Remember, he was procurator, so he appeals to the legate, saying, "We need your legions down here. The Jews are in open revolt against Rome." And during this period, three different men rose up and claimed to be the Messiah. One was Judas, a zealot from Galilee. Father was a zealot, well-known zealot. Judas was another zealot. He said that he was the Messiah, and he would lead them against Rome. Another was Simon, a royal slave over in Perea across the Jordan River, rose up and said that he was the Messiah. And if the people would follow him, he would lead them to freedom against Rome. And the third was Athronges, who is a shepherd in Judea, rose up and said, no, he was the Messiah. He and his brothers all agreed he was the Messiah. They needed to follow the shepherd because he's like David, right? Shepherd king. So they had three messiahs. We have a civil war. We have the procurator calling for troops from Syria. In fact, the writing was so bad, the legate of Syria sent all three of his legions, and he led them, which, you know, if you know Roman, you know, you don't send three legions to do very much of anything, especially against what should be peaceful lands. But he sent all three of his legions. He led them down into Judea. And he thought the fighting was so bad, he asked King Aretas of Arabia, who was a friend and ally of Rome, to honor his alliance and to send his troops north into Judea. He didn't think his three legions were enough to pacify Judea. That's how violent the revolt was at this point. And King Aretas did send his troops. The Romans numbered their losses in the thousands, basically a legion worth of men. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 men of Rome died in the fighting. The Jews numbered their losses in the tens of thousands. Josephus numbers it somewhere around 100,000 or more killed by the Romans in the fighting. Varus, the legate, caught 2,000 that he thought were the ringleaders, or at least upper. He didn't catch any of the three messiahs. But he caught 2,000 of those who were, he thought, leaders in the various troops. He waited until Archelaus came home, and then with Archelaus in attendance, crucified all 2,000 in the streets outside Jerusalem, trying to make a statement. And so when you think Matthew 2, I mean, this is all the first year of Archelaus. I mean, he's not even been on the throne a year. Think Joseph comes back and hears Archelaus is on the throne, and he decides, I'm going to go to Nazareth. You know, I'm not going to be anywhere inside Archelaus's territory. You know, there's just been a full 1 year civil war. People have been killing. You can see God's wisdom telling him to stay in Egypt. You know, they stayed in Egypt a while. The war has gone on. It may have still been going on. We don't know exactly when Mary and Joseph came back. If the war was still going on, it certainly would have made sense to go around up to Galilee. Another thing that might be similar is one of the parables of Jesus. I just wanted to point this out. Somebody turn to Luke 19. It's verses 12, 14 to 15, and then jump forward to verse 27. And as somebody reads this parable for us, think about Archelaus and the story we just told. Somebody read it. Those verses.
He said, "Therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, 'We do not want this man to reign over us.' When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. But as for these enemies of mine, who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me."
And some people think Jesus might have been, that's the parable of the minas, but he might have been setting it, you know, as a story that they would all be familiar with, you know, because it does read kind of like Archelaus, you know, and the idea of, you know, what he did and, you know, the things that happened while he was gone and when he came back. Just to continue with Archelaus, he married Mariamne the third, and she was the daughter of Berenice and Aristobulus. See, we keep coming back to that couple. I said, you know, keep them in mind. They're going to... Berenice was the daughter of Salome. Aristobulus was Archelaus' half-brother, so he was marrying his niece's daughter, but also his half-brother's daughter. She had actually been betrothed to Antipater, but of course Antipater's dead now. And the Pharisees said, "Hey, that's incest. Why is it incest?" He'd married his niece. All right, Leviticus 18, verse 14. You can't marry your uncle, is how it's phrased there, but you know that makes it incest. The Pharisees said, you know, you can't do that. Those who protested too loudly disappeared. We all know what happened. It's Herod's family, after all. A few years later, though, he meets Glaphyra. She was the daughter of the Cappadocian king that was married to Alexander. Remember, Alexander was killed. After Alexander was killed, Glaphyra was married to Juba, the king of Mauritania, or what we'd call Morocco today. So she went from being the daughter of a king to married to the son of a king to being married to a king. She was visiting, or actually her husband was visiting. She was with him, and Archelaus and her had an affair. They decided to marry each other, so they each divorced their spouse. You can see, the Pharisees got mad about that as well, of course, because now we have both incest, because he was married to his brother's wife, Leviticus 18, and an unlawful divorce, woman divorcing her husband. And again, this time it was just obvious. He just had them killed, those who protested. So you can see that John the Baptist isn't the only one who died for similar reasons, protesting. By 86, though, Augustus was receiving basically a nonstop stream of dignitaries and delegations coming to tell him, "You've got to get rid of Archelaus. He's just, you know, he's killing our people. The king of Mauritania is sending a delegation. He stole my wife. The father, king of Cappadocia, is sending a delegation. He's, you know, he's ran off with my daughter." Emperor Augustus just decides, well, we'll need to bring him here for trial. Glaphyra, in the meantime, tells her friends that she had a dream that her dead husband, Alexander, came to her and berated her for having married his brother and told her that soon they would be together. She told her friends. The next day she was dead. Archelaus went to Rome, and he was found guilty of cruelty and misrule. And he was sentenced to exile into Gaul, to the town of Vienne, which is still named Vienne. And he died, that's another mistake on there, he didn't die in 86. He was deposed in AD 6. He died in AD 18. And before you feel, of course, you're not going to feel sorry for him, right? It's Archelaus. Vienne is in the French Riviera. That's where he spent the last 12 years. His father had a palace there, so he was kicked out and told to go live in a palace in the French Riviera. So that's how he spent the last 12 years of his life. And Judea then became an imperial province once again with a prefect. And we'll continue the story with the other brothers and finish it off next week, Lord willing.